Blog Talk Radio.
Good evening, everybody. This is the All Natural Henry and the Inconspicuous Hiker Show. It's the first episode. I'm broadcasting from Cupertino, California. Henry's in Huntington Beach. And our special guest tonight is Tim, who's in Grants Pass, Oregon. And this show is about basically, well, what we do is support the all-natural environment. So all our discussions and everything we talk about will be focused on that support that we give and that we, you know, we have gratitude for, that because it supports us. The water, the air, the food, it all supports us here living on this planet. So we think it should be given some attention. A lot of people are out there that are taking it for granted, all the things we have, and in the meantime, destroying it. Our water is being destroyed and being controlled, by the way. And food is being poisoned, and the air is being chemtrailed. So on the show, we're going to just talk about certain things and it makes sense and help people wake up. How are you, Henry? How is it down there in Huntington Beach?
Yeah, it's all good. I was doing some urban hiking today on the beach and watching people, and a lot of people, they're not used to walking barefoot, and some of them don't even walk barefoot on the beach, and they're not used to walking on some ground that's not, you know, so rigid as concrete and carpet within a house and things like that. So, you know, I was just seeing how people, they're not used to walking on a natural landscape, which is not, you know, a straight line like everything here in the modern society. And so it was a bit of fun. Did some urban hiking, crawled along the sand, and getting prepared for more hikes outside of the city. Now, if you could mute when you're not talking, Dean Val, that'd be great, because we can hear your background noise there.
Okay, I'll mute when I'm not talking.
Mm-hmm. And so, yeah, I've been looking forward to the show today to listen to Tim's experiences hiking and walking around the natural landscapes of the earth. I understand that Tim has walked a long ways and a lot of places to do a lot of different things, so it'll be fun to listen to Tim's stories there from, you know, Oregon and Washington and Alaska and anywhere else you've been. I think I've heard.
Can you hear me?
Yes, we can hear you. Yes.
Okay. Yeah, I understand why people don't walk barefoot on the beach anymore, because of the hypodermic needles and other things that are possibly in the very sand they'd walk on. It's got to be that there's so many people on drugs, whether they're the prescription drugs or the illegal drugs, that it's almost like a majority of the younger people, now the legalization of the marijuana in many states like here in Oregon, and it just seems like there's still mountains and places where we can go that we don't have to worry or be concerned about too much of the pollution, except for maybe some broken bottles or just old traps for the animals or something that are still set. But anyway, I do understand why people would be concerned to walk even barefoot on this earth anymore in places. I've seen a lot of the changes here in Southwest Oregon, in our hills, that for many years it started out that they mined for the gold, And there were some pockets that this area is pretty famous for that were on the surface. And they found certain ore chutes that were the main employment of the county in the original days, some of the mines. And then after the mining kind of changed, it became a logging area, because we have the fir trees and we have the pine trees, have a big variety of the oaks and the hardwoods too, madrone, and then we have like the cedars that grow in the drainages or wherever there's constant water, like the Port Orford cedar. It needs constant water. It only lives where it can have constant water. So I ended up finding a way to work on the dead cedar and stuff that was dead and down in this area. So I split lots of fence posts and lots of rails. For a certain amount of years, that's mainly what I was doing for my time. A lot of my time anyway. And there was a thing that took
that
place.
What does that mean, Tim? Splitting rails or fence posts? Can you explain that a bit?
Yeah, sure. You hunt around in the hills on the logging roads and you look for where there's some dead cedar. A lot of it, when it's standing, it becomes very ancient. It's almost like I think that in some places I've cut some of the original trees that were existed after this last ice age or the beginning of them again, whether who knows how they started again, but they get to be silver and they have no bark. And they have no limbs, and the very air itself just works on them for centuries, and it leaves a beautiful silvery gray little dents all indented into the wood. All the bark and the sapwood has been long gone, so it's just the solid wood that's left stand, and then they fall down, get knocked down by other trees too and things like that, so they're laying. So then you have to deal with mainly the government, the Forest Service, to get a permit so you can cut the dead wood up and split it up with I started out with wedges and a sledgehammer, but then I found out that there was a thing called a splitting maul. So I found out that worked pretty good because you can pound the wedges and get a good crack, and that then you can hit it with the splitting maul. One end's like a sledgehammer and the other end's like a blunt axe, kind of. And some of the trees were so ancient that after they were cut down and mark them into 10-foot pieces, if they're good for rail wood without the knots and just being real nice wood. And the butts are tough, so you make them into the short fence posts for the rail fences. And I supplied a lot of the fence posts for the farmers, the cattle people and the horse people here in the Rogue Valley and the Applegate Valley and the Illinois Valley and around this area. I was the main fence post manufacturer when I started. Let's see, if that was the end of the 70s, I could buy the fence post for 10 cents a post, and it was an honor system dealing with the forestry back then. So I could buy like 1,000 fence posts for $100. And then I could sell them. At that time, I'd sell like 300 at a time for $500, which was like $1.67 a post or so. And So it was just a way to make income. But at the time, too, I was in a lifestyle of drinking and gambling and smoking. So that's pretty much what I would spend my money mainly on. I didn't have too many demands otherwise about paying to live somewhere or bills. But anyway, I've seen where the logging not only cut down the forest, mainly they clear cut, and I'd done some of that, worked on some of that up in the state of Washington when I was about 18. I went to work for Weyerhaeuser up at Snoqualmie Falls in the state of Washington. And back then they started me out like, what was it? Oh, 287 and a half an hour or something. They gave you travel time like a dime a, or I forget, a penny a mile or something to go up in the mountains. And they have these big machines that have giant cables that run down the hillside after they cut down all the trees and buck them up and limb them. And then what I was doing part of that time, I would go down and hook a choker, a cable that wraps around the tree and hooks into a an end that has a fitting for the other end of the cable that it's called a choker bell. And so you hook it up and then you have a signal thing that you're out of the way and you're hooked up, and then that big high lead machine gives his signal that he's going to pull, and so he yanks up the trees you've got hooked up way up the hillside on a great big cable to a landing, and then they have their loaders and load the log trucks. It's pretty devastating, but in the state of Washington, the timber grows like hair on most people's heads. You cut it down, and it just comes back like crazy. The second growth, or actually, they only had 7 years of first growth timber left in the state of Oregon back then when I was working for Weyerhaeuser in the end of the 60s. They'd wiped out the whole virgin forest in the whole state, just about. And down here, besides going to work at a lumber mill out in this area, got to experience that kind of stuff about the wood too. I took the place of a guy that fell through into a conveyor and went up and got chopped up in the thing that makes wood chips. And I was pretty young, and it was spotting on a trim saw, and you dance around and throw the bark and the stuff that's cut off, the good stuff, down below you into the conveyor that goes up to the chipper thing. Well, he'd fallen in, I guess, and knocked himself out, and nobody knew, and he went up and got ground up. So anyway, I wasn't too happy with that job. It was the most accidents in the state of Oregon that particular mill had, the Robert Dollar Lumber Company it was. So anyway, and I remember they paid me $3.22 an hour, which was better than the Weyerhaeuser had paid me up there in Washington. But down here, as I was splitting posts and things and seeing all the logging that they'd done in this area, they had a thing they call Port Orford root rot. That's what they called it. And it killed a lot of the Port Orford cedar that were in the drainages. I'm not quite sure if it really was root rot. That's what they that have taken their educational classes and stuff were trying to convince everybody that it was some root rot or something disease that was killing these virgin drainages with the Port Orford cedar. And from all the splitting that I did on the dead wood, I would see that there was some kind of beetle under the bark that made patterns all around the contact between the bark, the inside of the bark and the tree, like living off of the sap or something. But I didn't really know for sure if it was them or if that was just because the trees had died that they lived that way. But then again, in the old days, it was pretty common for the logging business to not care, it seemed like, about the environment at all, whether the big old bulldozer or their yarders or, you know, big equipment, when they changed the oil and stuff, well, that would be just dumped right on the ground. That's just, you know, who cared? Nobody was telling them not to or what to do with it. So that stuff gets down into those waterways, and that's where the Port Orford cedar grows. It's actually a cypress. They call it Port Orford cedar, but it's actually a cypress tree. But anyway, so I wondered, you know, in my mind, just wonder if it was partly because of how they had polluted our beautiful clean creeks that the cedar grow on the banks and have their constant water supply. And then I've spent quite a bit of time in the prospect and going all over the place, out into the wilderness. This was in about the end of the 70s in this area. I would be hunting for gold mainly. And I met an old couple. Well, I met a fella that he'd been out there in the wilderness before at this couple's place. It was called Emily Cabin. And Mr. Emily had been there in the original days. He came over on a ship from England. And anyway, he came up, I guess, either from Crescent City or somewhere up the drainage, the Chetco River drainage, and it goes up there to the Little Chetco. And he'd worked a high bar, and the hearsay was that he got 1,000 ounces of gold working, you know, would be, that's not in the creek, that's above the creek a ways, and then he would bring the water on and clean the crevices, the overburden, the gravel and rocks and whatever was on the bar growing, and he got 1,000 ounces. So in those days, the story goes that he went back to England a rich man, sailed back. But Ruth and Perry Davis, they were, I guess you'd call them recluses or something, and I kind of understand why Perry was that way, because he'd been in the war, the Second World War. He was a naval commander, and he'd had three ships blown out from underneath him, a lot of people dying, but he'd survived. And first they'd come up the Windchuck River here on the Oregon coast by the California border. And then somehow or another they found out about up there in the Little Chetco that where Emily had been. And they fixed up the cabin and made themselves a place to live, very secluded, nobody for miles and miles, no neighbors at all. And they could only go out in the summer after the snow drifts up to the top of the mountain would melt off enough. There was just a rough road, and he had an old Willie's truck with real, like 12-ply military tires on it, and so they could go out and get their staples, their groceries in the summer, what they needed to stock up. But they got to work in the bar with not much more than a garden hose, and they uncovered one crevice that Emily had missed, and they washed out with their garden hose 68 ounces of gold, and they decided that they were going to go take themselves an adventure sailing. And they did that, and like they went over there to the Hawaiian Islands, and they went to I think the island was called Molokai or something. And back then when they went, the people were very untouched by mankind, and they didn't have anything like this modern man that mainland America had, like sewing machines or anything like that. So, but they were very friendly and welcoming. And Ruth and Perry, I guess they made another trip back to the people there, and they brought some things like sewing machines and things that the people could use there, thinking that that would be beneficial for them and make their life a little easier or something. And the people were so grateful that they loaded their boat up with so much stuff. Ruth and Perry were saying that they had to, when they left, they had to unload a lot of it into the ocean. It was just too much, all the fruits and things that the people had given them for the things that they had brought them. So they were an interesting couple, and they stayed out there into their late years, and eventually they passed on, and their ashes are on the road that overlooks the Illinois River, and that's, I guess, where they wanted their remains to be thrown. It's a beautiful lookout on the road up Fiddler Mountain on the way to the wilderness up there. And the wilderness area, I met an Indian lady. I was going out a different part of the wilderness to a place called Tin Cup Creek. And there was a road that goes across the river, a low water bridge that Mr. McCaleb, the man's name, had made. Mr. and Mrs. McCaleb, when they were first married, that was way back, he was a miner, and he mined up in that area, and they made a road up there to Chetco Pass. And I wanted to go up that road to where I was headed, so I asked her, and she's got a house down there in the bottom, if it was all right if I used her road to go up to the pass and out there to Tin Cup Creek to go prospect out in the wilderness. And she was telling me about an old man that she'd met when she was a young gal up there, first married, and when they first moved in and bought the area that she was living on. Mr. McCaleb had passed away. And she had lots of things to talk about, but she told me about a man called Professor White, that they used to ride their horses up and visit, and they'd have to, Mr. McCaleb would have to go up first to check on Professor White, because he was an old mining recluse up there, and he had long white hair and long white beard, she said, and he worked, you know, in the summertime with no clothes on. And so that's why Mr. McCaleb would have to ride up and check on him to see, to get him to put on some clothes or something for Mrs. McCaleb to come up. But she said he always had a rifle right there by him where he was working, and he wasn't the social kind, and he would tell anybody that came up the creek that he had it all claimed, and not to come back or he'd shoot them. So that was kind of, but anyway, he would, Mrs. McCaleb said that Professor White had stored his gold in the store in Selma, which is like 7-10 miles away from where he lived up there in the hills on Fall Creek. And that he had told the storekeep, he told Mrs. McCaleb she could see his gold. He'd left, told the storekeep when he'd seen him to show Mrs. McCaleb his gold. So she said that she went in and the storekeep got Professor White's gold out of the safe and had 5-quart jars of thumb-sized nuggets. So I ended up in that. She sent me up Fall Creek, and I prospected up there and found nuggets, but they weren't plentiful for me. The way I was working it, pretty much by hand stuff, but it was very beautiful. That part of the mountains were untouched, so the native trees were all first growth. All the cedars and all the firs and all the pines and the other variety too of the oaks and things that grow in that area. And you could see the great big claw marks very high up on the big cedar trees where the grizzly bears in the old days had made their markings. And it was very amazing how big those grizzly bears were able to reach up, way up higher than the black bears to make their markings. The bears do that. They mark their areas by the biggest bear is the one that reaches the highest. So the other bear, if he don't reach as high with his claw marks, he understands there's a bigger bear in the area and he better go find somewhere else as they're territorial for their areas to have their babies or whatever. And but anyway, it's very beautiful, that country. I really enjoyed it a lot. It felt very good to get out there and the beautiful untouched rugged country. And then eventually 2002 it was, I was up there. And there was a lightning storm in the heat of summer, early summer, and it barely dropped any moisture at all. I mean, just hardly anything at all. Just a little bit of pitter-patter for just some minutes. But it started multiple fires. And it started them all the way down into Northern California and up through the Calamiopsis Wilderness, where I was on the edge of at Fall Creek. But anyway, there was other fires going on in the country. And so the resources were all spread out, I guess, or whatever. They just decided they couldn't fight it or it wasn't worth fighting in the wilderness. And anyway, it burned up 500,000 acres of the wilderness. It was cremated pretty much. There were some patches that survived in certain areas, but most of everything got burned up and killed, right? Just cremated the place. Just a bunch of spikes of dead trees sticking up all over, burnt bark and... And so it was a very drastic change took place from that particular lightning storm, which was what I understood, because there were big burn marks and many of the first growth timber around their butts where the fire had come through many years before, but it didn't kill the trees. It just burned their bases and they lived. Back when Captain Cook was exploring the West Coast, I understand for 7 days sailing up the West Coast, the whole country was on fire, but it didn't kill the forest. It was the kind of fire that they lived through. It burned underbrush and things like that a lot more but this killed just about everything. It was just a terrible, intense fire, which it's still, it's never going to be like that for centuries like it was. And all that came back was the hardwoods from the roots, because they grow back from roots after a fire, the brush and the hardwoods. And now we've had this last summer, it went and burned it all up again, all this brush and everything out that in that country. Another big burn. But that's just such a drastic change. It's very shocking when something like that takes place in an area that you think, oh, this is going to be so beautiful forever, or whatever the idea is, or going to be around a lot longer than us physical bodies for our time, physical time on Earth. But it is very drastic at times what takes place on the Earth. And now I'm seeing these things like Fukushima poisoning the ocean, and mankind not coming together and stopping it from poisoning the ocean, concealing it or whatever it needs to be with all our modern capabilities and technology. You think they could build dams and everything and cut Panama canals, and why can't they just conceal all this radioactive poison that's being dumped into the ocean over there, and it just keeps dumping in? And not only the ocean, then we see our air, and we see all these what's called chemtrails, and we hear that, oh, this stuff's got poison in the air from them, besides all the vehicles putting out all the carbon monoxide or whatever it is, millions and millions of them running all over this planet constantly, day and night, the ships, the trains, the planes. It's just amazing how we've even got to last this long, or whatever it's going to take to get mankind's attention to quit poisoning themselves. Here we have this world going what seems to be insane, drugs and alcohol and going along with all this modern technology that sounds like the radiation from it. They think, oh, that's fine, it's not going to hurt us. Well, it was just like the radium dials on watches, and the people that made the watches all got cancer from this that small amount of radiation that they were dealing with. And it just seems like it's going to, I don't really see mankind having much of a chance unless they pay attention to somebody that really knows what's going on and can make them, I don't know if that's the right word, make them, but awaken them or make them aware of all this pollution is destroying their own lives, their health and the beauty of the planet, besides the taste of their foods, the vegetables. They seem like this Monsanto stuff. You buy a tomato in the store and it's like a potato. It looks nice, but it doesn't have flavor, and it's hard, and so much of that kind of stuff's going on. It's just amazing. All this plastic stuff, our landfills of all kinds of toxins being put into the earth, and the earth's got the water running through it, and it's seeping into the water in many places. It's just like the beaches where the rivers run into the ocean, where people just use the river as their garbage dump. If it got something they don't want, they throw it in the river. It don't matter to them whether baby diapers or anything that they just don't want. They just think, oh, I'll throw it in the river, get rid of it, I don't want it around me. But they don't care about the river and the little fish that live in the river, and mankind seems to not care, and it seems like the majority of mankind is only interested in material things, money and cars and houses and boats and planes and everything, that they're diamonds and gold, and I guess that's fine. We all probably have to experience all these things to become aware of the effects of them. Even those that seem to be so rich, it seems like they're not happy, or many of them, it seems like if something isn't the way they want it in life, they just commit suicide. And that's another thing, when I start thinking about these things like suicide and hearing about these powers of mind control and how they can make people's brains think certain ways, and they can actually make people commit suicide and other things too. So at this point, it's just like, if we're like children at heart, we don't want to eat stuff that's actually bad for us. They make it seem like a lot of things that we get used to, the taste and things that, oh, it tastes good, so we like it, and we get addicted to these foods, and actually they're not good for us. We don't have enough sense to know better. We think this is the way life is. We enjoy things, and we've been accepting all these things as, oh, that's just the way it is, nothing we can do about it. Well, maybe there isn't on this particular speck of dirt out here in this physical realm. It is amazing that, though, that at any time, whether it's a comet from space or many different ways, atomic explosions or even volcanoes on our very earth could annihilate mankind. And then what good does anything material matter? You just had the experience. And so it is very beautiful in places on earth. I've been in Hawaii and on the Kona coast at Kailua, and the ocean. I was surprised how actually comfortable the temperature of it is, and the clarity of it too, because where I grew up in Puget Sound, the ocean is, it's an inland sound, but it's salt water and it's very deep. I lived on Whidbey Island and I had to take the ferry boat to get to the mainland, and the pulp mills up there had polluted the sound so bad that I was just thinking that all the oceans of the earth were dark and not clear, until I got to take a cabin cruiser ride with a friend and his parents up through Deception Pass out to the San Juan Islands. And I found out, oh, look at this, the ocean, I can see through it. I can see it was clear, because in Puget Sound, it's just dark. They dumped all that pulp mill, whatever stuff, into the ocean for many years. And I knew an old man and lady on Whidbey Island when I was young, were self-sufficient, grew all their own fruits and vegetables and everything they needed. They lived to be around 100 and had good health. And old Will had told me about when he was younger that he'd shipped clams, barged clams from Dogfish Point on Whidbey Island to Seattle. And he told me about the salmon used to come in so thick when they'd come in that you could practically walk across them. It's like 3 miles across down the sound to get to the mainland there. And I was amazed, because they sure fished it out pretty hard for many years, the big purse seiners and all that. And nothing like it, like that anymore. The rivers aren't plugged with salmon coming up, but somehow they do manage to survive enough, I guess. Down here, that's another thing. They took out the dam that the people had put in for their irrigation and for their recreation. They could have their boats and on the reservoir behind the dam, and they could have their float planes land in there and their places to stay on the shore. Very beautiful. And so they say, it's the dam causing the problem with the fish going up and down the river. They had a fish ladder, and you could see the fish coming up the fish ladder. So anyway, they spent lots of money and tore out the dam, and that was the end of that beautiful area of recreation and the houses and all that were along it for the beauty of it when it had the lake there or whatever you want to call it. And they put in giant electric pumps. Well, they were going to cure the problem of the dam being the problem, they say, with all their studying that was making the fish less plentiful. And so they put in these big electric pumps right here, 5 miles from me on the Rogue River. And they pump the water into the canal now. And it used to be a natural gravity flow. There wasn't any pumping. And they thought that these pumps would work fine and, you know, be able to provide water for irrigation for the valley. And what has actually been observed by myself is that the canal gets just loads and loads of the baby fish dumped by the pumps and put into the canal, and then they shut off the canal at a certain time of the year and they all die. And there's hardly any fish compared to what there used to be when the dam was there. Now they won't even let you go salmon fishing and keep any of the salmon. There's so few coming up. So maybe their intention was to try to make things better, but in my eyes, I don't see it. It's how people have ideas, but their ideas aren't always don't always come out the way they say or think they want them to. So we've got the river being also used by these big jet boats for the tourists going down through the Hellgate Canyon here. It's getting pretty famous, and people used to be able to go down, you know, in the old days, we'd go down on a big old inner tube and float the river down and stuff like that. Well, nowadays, the big jet boats it's hard to be on the river with them going up and down too. But a lot of people do raft still, and I guess they're watching enough. But it is interesting, and the effects of how all that roaring and stuff affect fish in the river. It's only so wide and so deep. And so many ways, it looks like mankind just doesn't seem to really care much about anything but their own selfish interests, pleasures, and maybe it's changing, but it looks like it's getting worse. I just see it as, well, they have stopped the logging pretty much, you know, compared to how they used to be destroying the forest the way they went about it. And there was a way that people could benefit from the beautiful wood, but just harvest the wood that's windfall down or died of the natural causes. And if they use the resources properly, then the forest would stay healthy and it wouldn't have so much fire danger either with the dry down wood laying around and all that kind of things. Besides, when those forest fires go through the areas, every living thing whether it's the chipmunks or squirrels or deer or bear or ring-tailed cats, on and on. It's hard. It's amazing that any of them survive. All the things that have been done by the logging and the fires, and it's just amazing that this all natural environment on Earth seems like huge efforts to destroy it or been taking place here in the last couple hundred years compared to what it had been for thousands of years before man decided he was going to do whatever he wanted to the forest and to everything. It's even like the animals. We've only got like 27 wolves left or something like that, or, you know, a very small amount in the state of Oregon, and they're, because they have to eat too, and they get some farmer's calf or sheep or something, and it's time for them to say, oh, it's okay to get rid of all the wolves on Earth again and stuff like that. It just seems like a lot of things that we interfere with, the world would be a better place if we didn't just leave things alone. There's other ways. You don't actually have to use wood for very many things that it's being used for. There's other materials, rocks and things like that, but it is amazing that what we're experiencing here and right now, how life is. But there is a lot of thankfulness that, from what I'm becoming aware of in my life at this time, that there are universal guides that are offering a way for people who are sincere to not have to come back to what's called these psych realms, this material realm and a causal realm and an astral realm and a mental realm and etheric realm. But there's with their guidance and their giving us the education, there is, and they're escorting us actually when we've earned our way through out of these psych realms, through the deep dark border that separates real universes, where we're free, not being controlled by governments or brutalitarians or aliens, or that the song being offered, the new you, is such a gift for mankind at this time, because it looks like this planet isn't going to be around very much longer. It looks like it's all going to be cremated, is actually what I'm thinking, or I guess that's just an idea that I have, that from the looks of what I'm observing or aware of, it looks like at any time they can push buttons and blow the place to pieces. So when all these things like the pharmaceutical drugs are affecting the humans and the animals, because it gets in the water and the air, and these radioactive things killing the insects and the poisoning of of their whatever they call it that they do, spray all over the fruits and vegetables to kill insects and bees, or on and on. It's just doesn't look like it's actually going to change. The powers that be that are doing it are making their, I guess you call it, money. And they're happy with what they're doing. And unless some big change takes place to force them to not continue doing what they're doing. There's going to be constant wars and constant poisoning of the air, water, and food. So if this, which makes human bodies deformed and have existences than ever before. And it's not a place that when we come into this life, some of us have been very fortunate to have been born healthy and very happy to exist with whatever you want to call it, loving families or just enjoying nature, the fruits and the flowers and the scents and all the beautiful things that we can experience and the joys of swimming and all these things. But now lakes and everything is just seems like it's getting to a point where it's not going to be healthy to even be out in what we call nature, to breathe the very air, to drink the very water or swim in it, or and the very foods we eat, to even find wholesome, fresh, unchanged natural fruits and vegetables. So the thankfulness is that can you still hear me?
Yes, we can hear you, Tim.
Oh, okay.
Yes.
Yeah, I've talked quite a bit, so I was just letting these thoughts of what I'm becoming aware of out there, if anybody's listening, but the big opportunity is to sincerely try to connect to the real guides through singing the new you song that's being offered to connect, to get real guidance and a real education and to earn our way to this psych realm stuff that only lasts so long anyway. I guess we're here to get these experiences and lessons so that we know what isn't real, like compared to what is real in the real universes. Is there anything anybody would like to ask?
Tim, that was great to share what you're sharing with your story and your view and your history. So we see that, you know, you coming from your background is more outside, more adventure, working with the environment. So it's really cool to see how you came up to see what Dwayne's presenting in the new presentation that he's developed, and that anybody can see what Dwayne's doing, no matter what their background is. That you see with him, which is natural, and that's what this show is more geared toward, the outdoors, hiking, adventure, exploring, and seeing what Dwayne's presenting through that aspect, through really taking a risk. And I don't mean jumping off a cliff, you know, but or bungee jumping, but just within yourself taking a risk and to see what more there is that you don't know about life. But it sure is a good start. The environment sure is a good start to start seeing what's real. You're gonna look at survival, which life is about, more in the face, more than being in an office building. Outdoors, you're gonna face that survival situation and really come up close to it face to face. And that's what life is about. It's really about survival, but on all levels, not just the physical. I mean, we have the five bodies, and each body has a life. And to get through those is a challenge. And it's also because they want to survive, each of these bodies. So it doesn't mean we're getting rid of them. It just means managing them in a certain way so that we can focus more on this reality that we call the all is. So
hello?
Yes, hello.
Oh, sorry, I was getting a lot of feedback in the background. I don't know if it's from the caller or if it was from me. I'm sorry. That's better. I can hear better now.
Well, that's me. I'm at Whole Foods. I've got background
noise.
Oh,
okay.
When I'm talking,
well,
I have to have the noise, but I'll shut it off when I'm not.
Oh,
so do you have a question
okay.
for Tim or a comment?
Yes. Well, Tim, you had started in with a song there, and it reminded me concerning your subject. There was a song. This is Howard, by the way. Hello.
Hi. Yeah,
hi.
The new you.
Well, but then
song.
It triggered a song in my head. Yesterday I had this song stuck in my head, and I don't know the lyrics, but I just sort of know the vibe. But you could probably help. Geez, God, I'll sing it for you. It goes, take me to the mountain. You take it to the sea, woo, 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 woo. I kept saying it to myself, you know? Do you know what that is?
Well, it sounds like you are aware of that being in your thoughts about the mountains and the sea.
Yeah.
So
I kept going there. Woo, woo, I kept saying it to myself. I'm trying to remember the song. Is that Mongo Jerry?
Oh, I don't know. I wasn't familiar with it, but...
No. Mongo Jerry was... that was in the summertime. But you know it. You know it. You got to know it. Whoa, break into the fire. You know? It's a great song.
Mm-hmm. I might have heard
it.
It
reminded me of what you were talking about.
Yeah. Well,
but
I would mention
who did it.
Yeah.
I was really upset.
Well, Howard, thanks for being here. We got to kind of cut off, and we'll be back
now,
next
come on,
week.
Come on. You can take it to the mountain. I think with the guy. Oh, God. No. This is bugging me now. Does it sound familiar
Howard,
to either
think,
of you at all?
Howard, you can just type the lyrics into Google or even better, maybe you just need to go to the mountain.
All right, shut up. Come on. You are a moron. I'm trying to get help here. Take it to the mountain. Nobody?
Howard, that's what the new you song is all about, connecting to some real guidance and a real education about what life's all about.
Yeah,
we've
muted,
only got like a.
I'm muted, Howard. He can listen to the show and he can look up Kelsey Lynn Brown Blog Talk Radio and listen to some of the other shows and see what we're doing. But our hour's up. We got to head on. Onto the trail, back to the trail, up the mountain, to the sea. And everybody, we'll see you next week, 6 o'clock Thursday. Thank you so much, Tim, for being on and sharing everything that you've done. You've led a really interesting life, and I'm glad you're with a new presentation and you see and are waking up now to what's going on. So thank you, Henry, and see everybody next week.
Yeah, see ya.
Okay.
Thanks, guys. That was fun.
Thank you.
Wait, does that mean that they can still go on?